It really was amazing how, you know, I'd forgotten about Katrina hitting on a Friday afternoon when we didn't know that, when us leaving for work, most of us leaving for work on a Friday afternoon, not me, but, and people were not realizing what was going to happen. So it's like a lot of people you never saw again. It was like they disappeared. Dr. Brent Wallace joins us now, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, to talk about health information and misinformation. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy, I'm great. How are you?
I am okay. It's easy to find health information online. Unfortunately, it's harder to make sure that that information is reliable. Dr. B from People's Health is here to debunk some common health myths and share some tips for spotting false or misleading claims. Let's start with some myths. Doc, does cracking your knuckles really cause arthritis?
Yeah, that's a good one, but there's actually no connection between cracking your knuckles and getting arthritis. It's really just little gas bubbles that can form between the bones in your fingers, and when you crack them, you're just popping those bubbles, so no harm to be done.
I've heard women tell their daughters, you keep cracking that knuckle, you'll never get a wedding ring on your finger. I guess that's a myth as well, right?
That is.
Do you need to get 10,000 steps a day?
No, you know, that's a good one. That recommendation actually has been kind of the gold standard for a long, long time. And where it started from was actually in Japan back in the 1960s. They created a pedometer that tracked your steps. And the Japanese character for the number 10,000 looks like a person walking. And so that's actually why that's why they use that number. So it was really just marketing, saying that 10,000 steps is what you needed to get. What you need to get is really consistent exercise whenever you can.
So counting steps, not that important, really?
No, I mean, it's a good way to kind of monitor your activity, but there really is no goal. It's going to be individualized by person.
Man, I love the origins of stuff. So the Japanese character for the company looked like a man walking. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, the character for the number 10,000 looks like a little person walking, and so that's why they chose it.
I love that. Do you need to wait 30 minutes before you swim?
This is a good one that I used to hear all the time when I was younger.
I thought it was an hour.
From my parents, yeah. No, so they're really, you know, the thought behind this one is that when you eat, all that blood is going to get diverted to your stomach so you can digest, and then that could result in getting cramps in your arms and legs, and you won't be able to swim. But really, that's not true. Your body has plenty of blood to support both digesting and moving around. It's why you don't get cramps when you walk around after eating or anything. So, you know, if you do eat right after eating, you may feel a little bit heavier, you may feel a little bloated, but the most you may get is a little bit of cramping in your legs, but nothing that's going to cause problems swimming.
Here's one that movie producers love. Do we really only use 10% of our brains?
Yeah, they've made a couple of movies about this, and this is actually not true either. Your brain is constantly active, whether you're awake or you're not awake, and we use different portions of our brain for different things that we do. You know, reading a book may use one portion, throwing a baseball may use another. So you're tapping different areas at different times, but you absolutely do use 100% of your brain.
It's not good when truth gets in the way of a good story, and that's a good story, but where did that myth come from?
Yeah, so that one came actually from the early 1900s. There was a Harvard psychologist that published some research saying that people only reach a fraction of their full mental potential. And what happened is that got picked up and popularized when all the self-help movement started. Mm-hmm. And that happened way back in the 1920s. So basically, they kind of converted it into something that could be more marketable. They put it in books, movies, TV shows, basically saying that, you know, we could have untapped potential to use our brain more than we do.
Seems like there's always money behind the myth.
Very often, yeah.
You know, every morning I weigh myself, and then I take a shower, and then I think about something for whatever reason. It always pops into my mind that a lady that lived in the neighborhood where I grew up who was obese, morbidly obese probably, was always looking to lose weight, and she said that you could lose weight by taking a shower. And every morning the silliness of that strikes me. But what about things like chewing celery? Does that burn more calories than you take in?
Yeah, so some people think that. It's not actually true. People say there are some foods that have negative calories, and, mm-hmm. and what that means is that the action of chewing and swallowing and digesting may actually burn more calories than you're actually taking in, and that would be fantastic. But if it were true, everybody would be eating those types of foods, and they really don't exist. You would have to eat so much celery for a very long period of time to get even close to burning the number of calories that you're taking in from the celery itself.
Let's talk about health information. Why is it important to find reliable sources?
Yeah, I mean, this is really critical. The myths we were talking about are relatively harmless, misinformation, but that's not always the case. A lot of times misinformation can really lead to bad health outcomes in particular. You know, if you're rejecting safe, established treatments in favor of unproven ones, that can actually worsen your health. And then, unfortunately, it may even reduce your trust in the doctors that are trying to care for you.
Matter of fact, I just coined a phrase, myth information. Tim, call the Secretary of State. Put a mark on that for me, please. I want to own that. What are some good sources of health information?
Yeah, so in general, you can trust information if it's coming from well-known sources in particular. So you want to look to things like hospitals that you've heard of before, medical schools, and professional organizations. So things like, you know, the Mayo Clinic and Harvard, everybody knows about that. The American Heart Association or the American Board of Pediatrics. Those are going to be reliable sources of information that are going to have more truthful information for you about your health.
How do you know if a web page is reliable, a specific page? Or I guess, first of all, if somebody just says it on Facebook, that would be one thing that you shouldn't trust. But what about, how do you know if a specific web page is reliable?
Yeah, like you said, be very cautious of social media because all sorts of things will get posted there. So, you know, a couple of things you can do when you're looking at a web page or doing any sort of research is look that the person that is publishing the material is current. You know, so there'll be a date usually on the website, and make sure that it isn't something from 20 or 30 years ago. You don't want to make decisions based on out-of-date information. And then the authors are really important as well, and you can generally trust information that's written by, healthcare professionals, scientific researcher, somebody who actually works in the field. If it's someone you've never heard of or you can't Google them and find additional information about them, it may not be that reliable. And then think about the source in particular you're looking at as well. If, you know, web pages, there's millions and millions of web pages with information on them, but make sure that they're coming from locations that actually list their citations and the references that they're using for that scientific research, and sometimes even go look at some of those references to make sure they're valid and contain true, you know, real, truthful health information.
So what are the warning flags when you shouldn't trust a source?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that you can watch for, but some of the big ones, for example, if a website is making grand claims, like, you know, you can lose 50 pounds in 2 weeks, be really wary of that. There's, you know, it's common sense. People know easy solutions to a really complex health problem are probably not true. And if it seems too good to be true, it probably is not.
Right. And it's not true. Right. You know, it's too good to be true.
Way. Yeah, exactly. Another thing is if it causes really strong feelings when you read it, that... Oh, did I lose you, Tommy?
No, I'm there, Doc.
Oh, sorry. I heard the music.
No, we're good. Yeah. Take your time.
Okay, yeah, if it causes really strong feelings, so, you know, misinformation is really heavy on emotion. It's trying to evoke either anger or fear in somebody. And so if that may be on purpose. So if that happens when you're reading something, it may not be accurate. And then the other big thing to look for is if the website is trying to sell you something, be very wary of it. If you can put your credit card number in there, then that website is actually trying to derive revenue from whatever that they're selling, and that could be misinformation that they're trying to sell as well.
Final advice, Doc?
Yeah, really, the most important thing is you be careful about the information you're reading. Be careful who you're talking to about your health information. Really, one of the best sources that you have overall is going to be to talk to your physician. You know, if we don't know the information, a lot of times we have access to resources and research. We can go find the information for you. So we're a really good asset. Make sure you use us for that.
Thank
for
you,
that
Doc.
Purpose.
Real quick, somebody texts in, do the ends of breads have more? Ends of bread have more nutrients?
They do not. They're just a little bit burned.
That was made up by somebody who didn't want to eat the burnt part. Thank you, Doc. Appreciate it. You can visit to find out more about People's Health. You can visit the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie. 3017 Vets between North Causeway and Trader Joe's. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. You can go to peopleshealth.com or call them at 1-800-978-9765. Time for traffic, WWL. 844, 16 till 9, we continue to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Katrina. Joined by Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans at Tulane. I got to believe it's Dr. Carroll, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I always forget that part.
Well, you know what? And I know you're not a medical doctor. I don't believe you are you?
No,
but you worked hard. You worked hard to get that PhD, and you deserve the title. Let's talk about the school.
My staff always has to remind me.
Well, that's humble. That's good. Tell me what the education system was like in New Orleans pre-Katrina, because as we've done this all week long, Doctor, I remember things that I thought I remembered, but they were not right. I did remember some things very clearly. Some things I don't remember at all. So remind us, what was the education system like in New Orleans pre-Katrina?
Right. So before Katrina, New Orleans was run like a traditional school district where there were certain schools that were zoned to certain areas, and all the schools were run by the local school district, Orleans Parish School Board. And overall, the outcomes for students were very low. We were ranked at the bottom of the state in high school graduation rates, student test scores, college entry rates. But that being said, there were some great schools that were educating wonderful people and still supporting their lives, but there was, you know, some corruption in the school district as well, financial issues, and things of that nature.
Well, and again, as you say that, I do remember that the FBI had set up an office in the New Orleans School Board headquarters, right?
Yes, that is true. And they're also, the school district was bankrupt basically at the time of the storm or before the storm hit, which I think plays into some of what happened after the storm.
Yeah, that just says a lot that the FBI would set up an office in the building organization that they were investigating. Tell us, Katrina hits. Then how do they even talk about New Orleans schools, and who was it that was saying, maybe we could do this, maybe we could do that, et cetera?
Yes. So almost immediately when the storm hit, a lot of the school district leaders and the district leaders, state school board members, and also state legislators got together to try to decide how are we going to do this. And Leslie Jacobs was one of the people at the time who was really leading the charge and trying to understand the way to redo the school system in New Orleans so that we can open schools quickly, so that we can get parents and families back, because people aren't going to move back if they're not schools to put their kids in. But at the same time, they didn't want to just go back to the same type of school system they had before. So they worked with laws that were already in place. So we had already had a law to allow the state to take over low performing schools. Mm-hmm. And transition them into charter schools. And so they built on that law to allow the state to take over any school that was performing below the state average at the time of the storm, which was all but 13 schools in the city. And so that law was passed in fall, and by January, some schools were opening, but we didn't really get most of the schools open until fall of 2006.
And I would imagine, you know, there was while there was a sense for urgency, there was also the realization that you couldn't keep doing things this way.
Right, exactly. I think that there was a thought that, one, the district was bankrupt before this happened, and rebuilding a school system takes a lot of money, and we weren't going to be getting that FEMA dollars in right away, as most of your audience probably knows. So we definitely, they wanted to open the schools quickly to be able to allow mechanisms for outside funding to come in and for the state to be able to pour funds into the system in a easier way than would have done if they had just kind of gone back to the traditional school district that they had before.
Was there any precedent for this? Anything even close that happened in another city?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because after Katrina, a lot, you know, it's like there's no, like, they tell you, doctor, when you have a kid that doesn't come with an instruction manual, when something like this happens, yes. There was nothing to look to, right?
Right. I mean, state takeovers of school districts have happened a lot over history in lots of different areas. Like, there was one in Newark. I think that was the earliest one. But the way this was done so quickly post-Katrina and the way that then all of the schools taken over by the state were transitioned into charter schools, that was completely unheard of. And the fact that now we are basically 100% charter, there's one non-charter school in our school system right now. There's nothing like that in the rest of the country. So as they were doing this, as they were planning this, and as that school district has grown in the past 20 years, there was not some place to look to learn from. We were the people that other people were looking to see how we were going to handle the situation.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. When we come back, we'll talk about the current state of the school system in Orleans Parish. And I'll also ask you a question that I asked Dr. Michael Cowan earlier, which is, but for Katrina, what would the state of the schools be? It can only be speculation, of course. We'll never know. But if those levies don't fail, what would the school system in Orleans Parish look like today? 850, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, couple of minutes left with Dr. Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans at Tulane. And we're talking about the differences in New Orleans public schools between now and Katrina. And I guess, doctor, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but if those flood walls don't collapse because Katrina missed us, just to be accurate, and the levees don't fail, where do you think the school system would be today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think there was already a push even before Katrina happened to do something to improve the schools in New Orleans. I think a lot of the same things would have happened. I think the state would have taken over schools, but they would have taken over fewer schools. They would have only taken the ones that were truly failing instead of using the benchmark of any school below the state average. And I think they would have converted those schools into charter schools. So I think we would have a decent share of charter schools in our system, but we would still have a lot of the traditional older schools that were still here back in the day that no longer exist. I taught at Clark High School after the storm, which is no longer a school. So I think that's kind of the balance. I think improvement would have occurred for sure, but probably not as drastic.
Let me interrupt for 1 second because we only have 90 seconds left, and I want to move to what, from speculation to what we know about the performance of students now compared to pre-Katrina.
Yes, so outcomes have increased widely in terms of student achievement, student high school graduation rates, student college enrollment rates. We went from the bottom of the state to about mid-state, and that has sustained over the past 10 years. The first 10 years is where we saw the most drastic growth, but this New Orleans district is doing much better than it was before the storm. Obviously, there's room for growth still, but lots of positive improvements in student outcomes.
Do you miss high school teaching?
I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Well, sometimes I miss it, and then I'm in a room with high schoolers, and then I'm like, no, I'm good.
Yeah, I've had enough. Thank you. Hey, thank you, Dr. Carroll. I appreciate your time and the work you do, okay?
Thanks so much.
You bet. Dr. Jamie Carroll, Associate Director for Research at the Education Research Alliance for New Orleans and Tulane. What'd you say? She's in a room with teenagers for a while, and then she says, I'm good. We'll come back, talk to Rebecca Dietz, President and CEO of City Park Conservancy, about the changes in City Park after Katrina and moving forward. And then we'll talk to Deuce about the Saints. A lot coming up. Stay with us, WWL.